Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
Hi, I'm Genevieve Coe. I'm a deputy editor and columnist at NYIT Cooking. And I think the only other thing I might love as much as food is the ocean. I love being in the ocean, so I'm trying to learn how to surf, both around the beaches in my native Southern California and also in the beaches around here in New York City in the Rockaways. But if I had to choose where I could really learn how to surf, it would definitely be Hawaii.
I'm Jesse Sparks, and this is The One Recipe, a podcast that turns to chefs and home cooks with a big question in mind. What is their one? That recipe that may have started off simple, but has grown and changed into their anywhere, anytime meal of choice. This week, we're having an incredibly sweet conversation about a favorite savory breakfast with Genevieve Coe. Genevieve is a deputy editor and columnist for the New York Times food section and the author of Better Baking. She's also co-authored cookbooks with food world heavyweights like Carla Hall, Mark Bittman, Pache Ong, Jean Georges, and more. But prestige aside, she's also the type of person whose kitchen you just want to nestle into and talk for hours with. To really understand, you got to hear for yourself. So here she is. Genevieve, hello.
Hi, Jesse.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
You say that like you haven't been working with all of these like culinary heavyweights, you know, being the go-to co-author for how many cookbooks now? I'm sorry, I can't count boy math and everything. How many cookbooks have you written and co-authored?
Gosh. You know, at last count, it was over 20. I think I've co-authored about a dozen, but then for many years, it was just constantly writing and putting stuff out there. It's always this weird question where people are like, 20, I haven't seen your name. I'm like, no. My name is not on all 20.
You're the angel overlooking so many chefs, keeping them from,
That's such a nice way of thinking of it. I think I tend to feel more like I'm like the little like mouse hiding in the corner, like making things happen.
Another thing that's always felt so striking to me about your work has also just been how compassionate your recipe development is, even beyond some of the logistics, right? You're always thinking about the reader at home who has the empty fridge, the long to-do list, and a growling stomach on top of it all. So how do you think your approach to cooking and writing has blossomed over the course of these 20 books and stints at Gourmet Magazine, LA Times, and the New York Times?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, how things change. I think what you said is so true. I think I've always approached this from this perspective of how can I help? Like, how can I help you? How can I help you have a really good meal at home? And what is asking too much? I, of course, want people to experiment, to try, of course, to try new ingredients, new techniques, but I'm also really mindful of time and exhaustion and intimidation, I think, is another thing that I think a lot about. Mm-hmm. And, of course, cooks have so many varied levels. And so in some cases with some chef books, I haven't changed a thing. All I've done is converted it into recipes that work in terms of, you know, the proportions and the numbers, and then written the recipes as full recipes out of a chef's shorthand, mm-hmm. because I know that there are cooks out there, actually including chefs, who buy these books to learn these dishes and have that capability. But most of my work is really meant for home cooks. And of course, even if you love cooking, that doesn't mean that you've done it professionally, or again, that you have the time or the energy to do it. And so, so that's just what I always think about. Like, is this step, is this extra ingredient, is this flourish, is that going to, you know, really like pay off in the end? Like it's, you know, it's like a business term, but like, what's your return on investment? And the investment is not just like the cost of the ingredient, but like the cost of your time or of having to wash your blender, right? Like, is it worth it? And sometimes it is. And sometimes it is. And we'll be like, hey, this is worth it. And other times it's like, well, you don't have to garnish with like finely chopped dill. If you know, if you don't have finely chopped dill, like that's okay. Like this will still be really tasty. I think when people read recipes, they really take them very seriously. So I always want to throw in that like optional. If it's truly optional, so that people know like it's okay. Like the dish will still be great without it.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
I know that you have gotten this question so many times, but in the course of the books and the projects that you take on, do you typically have a vision for exactly what the outcome will look like? Or do you more take on projects that pique your fancy and you're just curious to see where they end up?
Yeah, I think, you know, the one vision that's really consistent is how do I help this person connect with people who are reading the book, whether or not they ever cook the recipes at all. I mean, in an ideal world, of course, they cook the recipes, but sometimes it's just getting to know them, right? Like, how do you tell this story? And sometimes this story is not necessarily a personal one, right? It's not necessarily memoirish, but sometimes it's the story of a cuisine. It's a story of a journey. It's, you know, something that really changes the way someone can think about the world or experience the world through food. And with each book, it just sort of depends on who that person is or what that story is. Yeah. So I that's how I often think of it. Yeah, I love to work on both on books and even our work here at the Times, right? I love to like, gosh, tell the stories that will really help people just learn more about the world. And that's, you know, a huge part of what I love is just helping people like feel excited about something new. Or about something old.
Right.
Too. Yeah, sometimes it's something really old, and that's all often really exciting too.
So I have grilled you enough about everyone else's recipes and other people's cookbooks and things you've done for everyone else. Now I want to know, what is your one recipe?
Well, the one recipe that I turn to time and time again on these, like, you know, I'm saying like these quick between meeting meals or even on these nights when I rush home and I'm like, oh no, what am I going to make? Is what I called at home when I was growing up, Don Bang. But a loose translation would be a scallion egg wrap. And ooh. So this is possibly the first savory recipe I ever made or learned when I was definitely younger than 10. I still remember I learned it from this cooking class that we had at my church. And my church is a Chinese American church, and it was very much my community that I grew up in. And so so my friends and I were almost all sort of the first generation, not sort of, but we were the first generation born in the U.S. to parents who had immigrated mainly from Hong Kong and Taiwan. And we had this cooking class, I remember, and I still remember Auntie Carol. So we called everyone auntie and uncle, even though they're not, you know, our blood relatives. So Auntie Carol taught us this class, and what she did is beat some eggs, put that into a skillet, basically with a tortilla, so that the egg cooked into the tortilla. And it was just this dish that was so fun and that we all loved making, we loved eating, and it bore some resemblance to the more traditional Taiwanese version, as well as a Northern Chinese version, where you actually cooked the egg onto a crepe, like on a homemade crepe. But we were just using a tortilla, like one, because we were small children. But almost all of us had actually had this dish at home and grown up eating this dish at home. And so it was really this merging of cultures, I think, out of convenience and out of location, too. So this was in a town city called Monterey Park in Los Angeles, and it borders East LA. And so when I was growing up, my whole community was primarily Asian American and also Mexican American, just given where we were. And so our supermarkets, both, you know, the quote-unquote, I don't know what I'm saying, quote-unquote, both the Asian markets as well as the Mexican markets, as well as like the just big old chain supermarkets, like carried a lot of the ingredients that we all used. And it wasn't really something that we thought too much about in terms of mixing things up, like using a tortilla in place of a homemade crepe for this egg dish. And it's just been a dish that has stayed with me to this very day. One, because I think really if you set a timer, I make it in less than 5 minutes.
You said 5 minutes, but...
No, it really is. Okay, so here's what I'll do. I take my tortilla and my eggs out of the fridge. I get a skillet going, you know. As the skillet's heating up, I don't even wait for the skillet to get hot. I just throw the tortilla in there first. So just throw the tortilla in there dry because I want to take the chill off from the fridge and also to make it nice and soft and pliable. And so I'll just have the tortilla in there, flip it for 30 seconds, a minute, just so that it's warm and not so stiff and hard. And then I will, in the simplest version, I will absolutely just add some oil to the pan and I'll crack the egg, an egg or two, depending on the size of your tortilla. So like one egg for a smaller tortilla, you know, two for a bigger one. I'll crack the eggs right in there. And while they're in there, I'll take chopsticks or a spatula or fork and actually break them up in the pan so that they're a little swirly. Yeah. So not totally scrambled, but swirled. So you have some streaks of white, but most of it is, you know, a sunny yellow color and then a few maybe darker pockets of yolk. And I'll let that set in a round. So I'll swirl it around to form a round about the same size as the tortilla that I'm using. And then once the bottom of that is set, but the top is still quite wet, I'll smack that tortilla right over the eggs. And I'll let it sit there for, you know, another 30 seconds or a minute so that I know that now the egg, as it's been cooking and the heat is rising up in that egg, it's fusing to the tortilla. And then I'll go ahead and flip the whole thing. So when you flip it, the egg, especially if you're using like a well-seasoned cast iron pan or a nonstick skillet, it'll just flip really easily. And then I'll warm up the tortilla side just a little bit more. And then that's a matter of personal preference, right? Like I like it so it's still just maybe tiny spots here and there where it's a bit crackly. Mm-hmm. But some people like it until it's like crisp. And at that point, right, you could, if you wanted, add more oil. You could even add a little sesame oil if you want to give it both flavor and crispness. Or you just take it right out of the pan and then you fold it any which way you want. You know, you can fold the tortilla just in half in triangles. You could roll it. And that's like the barest bone version. It's nice with some sauce, right? Like I sometimes will just have it straight up like that. Oh, I forgot to mention seasoning the egg. Sorry. After you've swirled the egg around, definitely give it some salt. Yeah, definitely give it some salt. If you want pepper, you know, black pepper's not for everyone, but, you know, you can give it salt and pepper. Then, no, it's super important. Because if you don't season the egg at that point, then it will be unseasoned.
It's a different thing altogether.
Then you will have an unseasoned egg.
And all of that cooking process is happening over medium heat, right? So it's all gentle, fast enough to quickly cook the egg and fuse it to the tortilla.
Yeah.
Short enough that you don't have to... you know, stand over it waiting for the connection.
Yeah, for sure.
So where do the scallions get in?
So that is like the super, super bare bones version. If you want to throw scallions in there, which I love to do, I actually will do the scallions and the oil before I add the eggs because I want the scallions to get a little singed. So I'll sizzle the scallions in oil a little bit, then I'll add the egg, and then I'll do the rest, you know, put the tortilla on, flip it over. So you'll have that like... you know, that lovely aroma from the scallions. And at that point, if you wanted to really make it closer to something that's called a jianbing, which is a northern Chinese specialty, at that point, you could drizzle it with a chili, like a fermented chili paste that's very common in northern Chinese cuisine. A close thing would be hoisin, which is a little more readily available. But that's a very strong flavor, so you only want to put a tiny bit of that. If you're into heat, you can absolutely do whatever chili sauce, chili crisp you want. And the other thing that is very common in those cuisines are like fried wonton strips. You can yes, sprinkle fried wonton strips in there. You can actually add lettuce in there as well. That's also very common, like a crunchy lettuce, like romaine that's been sliced. So a jianbing is basically what I'm describing, but usually, again, it's like a homemade crepe. And so the texture you're getting is actually soft and tender from the outside into like the crunchiest crunch on the inside. Does that make sense? Like the outside might have a little, yeah, it might have a little bit of that like crackly edge from the outside of the tortilla. But then once you get to the middle, you have all this crunch. So that's like a full meal version of this dish.
Oh, and that's perfect. From there, you can wrap it up like a burrito. You can cut it into triangles. You can just fold it in half.
You can roll it. You can, yeah.
This is such a perfect meal, and I have just enough time to go and make one now. Genevieve, thank you so much for sharing this recipe with me and just coming on to the show.
Oh, Jesse, thank you so much for having me.
It's been great talking to you. Genevieve Koh is a cookbook author and a deputy editor and columnist at the New York Times food section. You can find that recipe for her scallion egg wrap on Instagram at the.one.recipe and at theonerecipe.org. And hey, if you liked what you heard, like and subscribe. It makes a world of difference. This week's episode was made for you by producer Erica Romero, associate producer Maria Wortel, technical director Derek Ramirez, and digital producer James Napoli. Sally Swift is our managing producer. APM Studios executives in charge are Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman is our executive producer. The One Recipe was created by Sally Swift and Erica Romero. I'm Jesse Sparks. This is APM Studios. Go make some magic.
I just feel like we are surrounded in this world by bullshit.
So how can you know what's real and what's not? Science passes. That's how. We answer questions like, does anti-aging skincare actually work? And what is your true personality type? And to answer these questions, we don't use opinions. We dive into the scientific studies, talk to the experts, and put it in a podcast that I know you are gonna love. Listen to Science Versus on Spotify.